Chapter 17. Solace. Jericho's anchor town was laid out in concentric rings, each showing the limit of a generation's ambition before the next influx of refugees arrived. Beyond the walls and the surrounding fields, the native plant life stretched away in clashing shades of yellow and indigo blue. Those trees moved, Solace knew. The fences kept up a modulated electromagnetic babble that repelled the local life, but the forest still made the odd slow rush for the barricades, overwhelming the fences until the farmers retaliated with chainsaws and flamethrowers. Even the trees were at war with people on Jericho. Then they were dropping the last 10 meters, the elevator car folding open so the bitter-scented alien air washed over them. Cargo crews were already descending on the elevator's freight compartments, using loading frames and A-grav to haul out the supplies, scientific equipment, and luxuries that had come down the wire. People were staring at Solace's armour, but she wasn't going to be down here without it. She made a big show of going to the luggage compartment and bringing out Mr. Punch. She'd had the name printed onto the accelerator's barrel, a little personal nod to Rollo's memory. The inhabitants of Anchortown looked a hardy lot, whose fashion ran to long sleeves, heavy boots to the knee, and high closed collars. Sensible, given the wildlife, and a world away from shipboard clothes. "Get some new clothes," Solace advised Chris and Idris. "Lots of things here to bite and sting and get under your skin." That meant a visit to the printers, while Solace soaked up the atmosphere outside, scowling at anyone who looked at her twice. There were Hugh military on the streets, and she saw them arrest one local at gunpoint. Nobody liked it. Nobody stepped in. This close to the anchor point, Hugh still had its colony in hand, likely towards the outskirts. It was a different story. And of course, those Hugh personnel looked at her just as hard as the locals did, and didn't look away as quickly. She was happy to see Chris and Idris emerge. Idris had purchased the drabbest, saddest long coat and boots she'd ever seen, but Chris had made an effort, sporting explorer chic and a new blue and yellow scarf to match the alien foliage. "I can't make contact with Trine," she told them. She'd been fitfully trying her comms since they got here, without any joy. "Can we not just go to their office?" Chris asked. Solace thought back and realised she might not have explained everything. "They're on a dig," she said. "I told you that." "I thought you meant, you know, some project." Waving a hand vaguely at the city around them, a gesture that slowed as Chris realised her mistake. "They're out in the wilds. That's where the ruins are. We'll need to arrange passage, and I need to call Trine somehow and tell them we're coming." "Is that even possible?" Idris asked. He had a crinkle of discomfort about his eyes. Solace wondered if the planet's EM chatter was impinging on his INT senses somehow. "They use the mother of all transmitter stations," Chris recalled from her research. "They cut through the background buzz via main force. I guess we go pay to put a call out." There was a transmitter office close enough to the anchor, beside a handful of seedy-looking shacks that claimed they could arrange expeditions into the wilds for you, though Solace assumed game hunting and smuggling eclipsed sorties for scientific research. Solace had kept in touch with Trine after the war, across the decades, when she wasn't in the freezer herself. Each time she'd woken, assuming that the Hiver would have re-instanced, that the intelligence she contacted wouldn't be her old correspondent. Each time, she discovered that Trine had clung on, still the same. And now they were going to meet. And she had one hell of a surprise for the old academic. The transmitter station managed to establish a link on the third try, then lost connection twice while she was waiting for someone to find Trine. "Can't you just lay a cable or something?" she asked the acnid operator, who shrugged.
"They eat it. Anything in the ground gets it," he said.
"This planet.
Oh, tell me about it."
And then they had the line again, and a crisp, slightly fuzzy-sounding voice was saying,
"Gold City Dig to Anchortown. Are you receiving me? Over."
"Gold City, this is Anchortown," Solis said obediently. "Communication for Asset Trine, over."
"Delegate Trine is speaking, Anchortown," the voice said, notably frosty,
and she knew it was her old acquaintance, for all the voice was unfamiliar. A Hiver voice was a matter of what software they plugged in after all.
"Delegate Trine, this is Myrmidon, Executor Solis, over?"
She found herself smiling.
"Well then, we've both had a promotion," came that precise voice. "Congratulations to everyone. You can't see me right now, but I've put on a tiny festive hat and am blowing on a little streamer."
Then static fuzzed up, and she lost the connection for a handful of frustrating seconds until their voice faded back in.
"Repeat, over?"
"Repeat yourself, over," she pressed. Fuzz, hiss, buzz.
"Saying you didn't come all this way for a party. Can it be the Parthenon has remembered me after all this time?"
"Trine, I've a matter befitting your expertise. Something special. Face-to-face discussion only. Can I come to you? Over."
"Can you fly in?"
"I'm told it's not advisable."
"But you have a ship. Repeating, you have a ship, yes?"
Solis frowned uneasily.
"I do. Over."
"Better than nothing. Base of the elevator."
Fuzz, buzz, hiss.
"Don't leave it longer. Est compris?"
"Compris, delegate."
"Then done. Over. Out. Whatever."
And the static rose like a tide and ended the connection for good. Solis stepped back from the transmitter, frowning, because there was obviously something else going on. You couldn't sift a Hiver's tone for emotional cues, but either something was worrying Trine, or the Hiver was having long-term instantiation issues. "I don't want to bring yet more trouble to the others," she thought. Yet, as she stepped out of the transmitter station, she saw they could find their own trouble. Chris and Idris had been cornered by none other than the Boyarin Paita Cheva Uscaro and a couple of his bottle-green Voyeni. As Solis strode over, she heard the Boyarin say,
"What else is a man to think, finding the int here, but that he's had a change of heart, that he wants to do best by his species after all?"
"Step away, please," Solis grated out, not quite pointing Mr. Punch his way. Paita Uscaro glanced about him, and Solis saw plenty of black looks sent her way by those rubbernecking nearby.
"Should I call those humorines over, Patho?" he asked. "Who will they back, do you think? I'm a citizen of the colonies with diplomatic credentials. You, on the other hand, are a foreign agent, and not even human."
Solis blanked. It wasn't his words alone, but the fact the crowd were plainly in agreement. She was surrounded by angry faces who probably believed all the anti-Parthenon propaganda. That sisters bore male children but murdered them at birth. That they poisoned water supplies to make men sterile. All the usual. However, she had shifted Uscaro slightly away from the pair, and the lawyer took full advantage, shoving Idris forward with a brisk, "Enough, we're going."
"I've not done with you."
The Boyarin reached out and hooked Chris by the scarf, pulling the garment half off. Solis moved to club the man and his goons if she had to, but he'd frozen. The Voyeni hovered in confusion. Solace couldn't see what had happened. A moment later, she realised Chris had a knife out. But the Boyarin had stopped before he'd seen it, his fingers still caught in the scarf.
Well?
Chris asked him. He'd gone pale, and the artful scar on his face twitched. Solace had no idea what question he was being asked, and it seemed Ascaro didn't know how to answer.
I can quote official protocols, so everyone can hear, Chris said calmly, quietly. But then, we're committed, Messenbruder.
The Boyarin stepped back, finally releasing her scarf. Solace magnified her field of vision through her visor and caught a glimpse of the pinkish line that encircled almost half the woman's neck. It was a thin cut, just like the blazon on the man's face, a very particular type of dueling scar.
Madame, Ascaro said coldly, our next meeting.
But Solace saw a faint glimmer of sweat on his forehead, despite the Jerrican climate.
The hell?
Idris exclaimed as the man marched off. People were still staring at Solace, and suddenly facing down colonial scorn didn't seem much fun anymore.
Just come on.
Chris had her scarf arranged again, hiding the scar. Solace wondered what sort of bloody mess that duel had been, to give her such a trophy. Not the mannered little game of blades that the Boyarin played. Messenbruder. Knife brother.
You,
she started. But Chris just brushed past, angrily.
I've arranged transport. We've got a land car to catch, being as that's the only way to get to this damn dig site of yours. If we miss it, I really will end up having to knife somebody.
Would you have actually...
Chris turned on her heel, and Solace decided that she'd never doubt the woman's readiness to take up her blade again. As they left, someone bounced a rock off Solace's shoulder guard. Better that than face up to an angry Chris.
Can you configure that thing for chain shot?
The biologist asked Solace, once they were past the last fence. Why would I need to? She eyed him, clutching Mr. Punch protectively. He was a wiry man named Rebellin, with dyed blonde hair and a strong accent that said he came from somewhere else, far away from Jericho.
Your sailor rider, he drawled, won't matter piss to the locals. Their fucking flesh is this viscous goop, and you've never seen the like, bastards. You send a pellet into them, just comes out the other side with its energy intact. Doesn't do a king's piss of a damage. Hereabouts we use these fuckers.
He showed her a chunky weapon with a barrel his fist would have fit inside.
Pops them with a beanbag, just about subsonic. Doesn't kill the bastards, but it makes a mess of them, and they don't like it. Do you get me?
Chain shot, right, Solace nodded. She made the necessary adjustments to Mr. Punch and glanced at the jungle, looming far too close on either side of the trail. A tracked ground car wasn't her preferred way of getting anywhere, but the locals wouldn't trust much else. Not between the planet's EM chaos and the way A-Grav systems attracted aerial predators like some kind of mating call.
Mockery of an ecosystem, this bloody place,
Rebellin went on easily.
There's no actual species here on this godforsaken world, you know that? Just things that have a shape. And if that shape ain't working for them, they start shifting into something else. These trees are only going to stay trees as long as it works for them. Bastards will morph into fucking balls of teeth and attitude the moment the soil gets too poor.
Abruptly, he had his beanbagger levelled in both hands, staring suspiciously into the jungle, or perhaps at the trees themselves.
Anything intelligent here? Idris asked faintly.
Official answer? Rebellin queried. Fuck knows, mate.
There were six others in the car besides Solis, Idris and Chris, their guide, Jon Rebellin, four new dig staff and an academic. They'd started out around midday and had driven through the night, then all the following day, before they set up a camp. The day after that, back on the trail, a thing like a tree had hoisted a junior archaeologist out of the car. Chris and a couple of others hung on to the victim's legs in a grim tug of war, while Rebellin went for the attacker with a chainsaw. Eventually, Solis scythed down seven entire trees with Mr. Punch. Presumably one of these had been the perpetrator. It felt like an identity parade gone horribly wrong, but at least their archaeologist was recovered intact.
"That," Rebellin reflected later, "is just bloody typical of this place. Whole new way of fucking you over since I was last out here."
"They learn," Solis asked. "The creatures here, from the human presence on the planet."
"Sure wish they didn't, but yes, learn and evolve," was his response. "Give them another 10 years, they'll be turning up wearing clothes and speaking Corval, and then eating people, because they'll still be the same nasty fuckers."
The next time they stopped to sleep, Solis got to see a groppler. Not a specific species, Rebellin said, but a predatory shape the locals took on. It came right into camp, and though it wasn't dressed or making conversation, its apparent arrogance seemed to fit with the biologist's gloomy predictions. One moment they were bedding down and setting out the proximity alarms. The next moment, this thing, half the size of the vehicle itself, had just sauntered into their midst. It was 3 meters tall and walked on 2 columnar legs, ending in thorned pads with jagged clutches of talons. Most of the front of it was mouth, easily big enough to slurp up any one of them, and it had a dozen tentacles like a beard reaching to the ground, all of them lined with vicious hooks. Its hide was a mottled blue-white that interacted weirdly with the yellow and azure foliage around it, making it leap out one moment, blend in the next. On either side of the mouth, there were big circular organs, probably not actually eyes.
"Fuck," said Rebellin.
He had his beanbag gun to hand, but the thing was right there in the middle of them, an invitation for friendly fire accidents. A gurgling rumble came from the creature's innards. Its body language now spoke of someone who'd stepped into a neighbour's hotel room by mistake, almost abashed. Then Idris shifted, and something about his furtive, prey-like movement caught the groppler's attention. "Idris," Solis cautioned, "you stay very still now." Idris was staring into that cavernous mouth. The tentacles swayed on a non-existent breeze, tasting the air.
"Any hot takes from the biology department?" Chris hissed.
Rebellin's eyes were narrowed.
"Fuckers have never done this before, far as I know."
He had his weapon levelled, but seemed reluctant to shoot.
"If I sting it and it goes on a rampage, that'll go bloody badly for us, I can tell you."
Solis brought her accelerator to her shoulder. "I am going to cut this creature in half now."
"Hold,"
said Idris hoarsely. He was staring at the groppler, and although it didn't seem to have anything to stare back at him with, its attention was increasingly fixed on him.
"Mate, I'd move back now if I were you,"
Rebellin advised Idris lightly.
"Hold,"
he said again. His narrow face had lost all expression, and Solis had a sudden chilling flashback. Seen this before. She almost pulled the trigger then and there, out of sheer reflex. Berlinhof, the Ents trying to reach the architects with their minds. Idris, with his face utterly slack. Nobody home, because his mind was out there, flying across the face of a moon-sized alien intelligence. Everyone was very silent now, watching the intermediary face the monster. The groppler stamped again, and its tentacles knotted and twitched, as though it was wringing its hands in embarrassment. Solace half expected Idris to reach out a hand and touch the monster's sagging skin, tame the thing, arrive at the dig riding a groppler in fulfillment of some bizarre local prophecy.
"Mate, seriously," Rebellin whispered. "I don't know what you're about, but that bastard will fucking eat you up and crap out the bits it can't digest."
"There's something. Oh,
hell."
Idris sat down suddenly. It seemed to surprise the groppler as much as anyone, because it took a skittish step away from him.
"You ever get ints here, Menhir Rebellin?"
"In this armpit place? Not bloody likely."
Then the groppler shook itself, like a man remembering a prior appointment, lurched sideways to general alarm, and stamped off into the jungle.
"Idris, what was that?"
Chris demanded, sounding furious with him, though Solace could tell it was mostly adrenaline. The intermediary held his head in his hands, as though to physically hold it together.
"Yon said the life here adapted."
"All the bloody time," Rebellin confirmed. "Listen, mate, like the lady says, what was that?"
"Originators," Idris said weakly. "The ruins here. I bet the local wildlife keeps clear of the sites, right?"
"The big fuckers, sure."
The biologist nodded warily.
"They don't like them."
Idris was abruptly running with sweat, despite the cool air. He looked absolutely wrung out with fatigue and nerves.
"Don't know why, but they know how to detect them, sure enough. They're on the same channel."
"As what?" Rebellin asked.
But Idris had clammed up and wouldn't say more. Solace knew what he'd left unsaid. The originator channel carried some indefinable signal, one that telegraphed the location of anything from that ancient civilization, even a handful of leftover junk. It broadcast so that even a moon-sized planet destroyer, up in high orbit, could detect its presence and would rather flee than risk a confrontation. It was the same channel that ints like Idris could access, that had let them touch the inhuman sentience of the architects and send them away. This planet hosted the most extensive set of originator ruins any human had ever seen. And here, the entire ecosphere was plugged right into that same channel and was listening. Two of Jericho's brief day and nights later, the trail finally led their grinding, complaining car to the dig site. They lurched abruptly over a rise and into a bowl-like crater, at least a kilometre across. As they did so, the dense foliage thinned out a little. The group was silent as they descended the incline. Laid out below, like the bones of time itself, was all that the originators had left behind.